तिरवदाचारि जय कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा मदावा जय कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा मदावा जय कुंज बिहारी। जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज कचार्यास्तोतरसत श्रीमाधे जिवाइंग वेस ऐसी भक्ति वेदांत स्वामी शिला प्रभुपाद की अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की इस्कॉन फाउंडर आचार्य शिला प्रभुपाद की ग्रंथ राशि मम भागवतां की निताई गौर परमानंदी। ओ ग्लोरी टू द सेंट ऑफ द वॉटर। ओ ग्लोरी टू द सेंट ऑफ द वॉटर। ओ ग्लोरी टू द सेंट ऑफ द वॉटर। ओ ग्लोरी टू श्री गुरु वंशी गुरु।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Today is a continuation of King Yayati Achieves Liberation, so it's Canto 9, Chapter 19 and Text 20. I'm pausing for everybody to get it on the electronic device. So, and the verse is also on the board, so I'll begin. Trishtam Shrutam Asad Bhutva Nanaduyayena Sandishet Samsritim Chatma Nasamcha Tatra vidvan satma drik Drishtam shrutam masad budva Nadu yayena sandhisit Samshritim chatma nashamcha Tatra vidvan saat madrik Drishtam shratam masad budvam Nanu dayayena sa so dishet Samsritim chatmana samcha Tatra vidvan saat madrik. Please chant. Drishtam shrutam asad budvam. Nudayena nasandishet. Samshritim chatmanasamcha. Tatra vidvan saat madrik Drishtam shrutam asad budvam Nanu dayayena sandishet samshritim jatmanasam cha tatra vidvansa atmatrik stam shrutam asat budvam nanu tayena sandishet samsritim chatmanasam cha tatra vidvansa atmadrik. The word for word, drishtam, the material enjoyment we experience in our present life. Shrutam, material enjoyment as promised to the fruit of workers for future happiness, either in this life or the next, in the heavenly planets and so on. Asat, all temporary and bad. Budva, knowing. Na, not. Anudayet, one should even think of. Na, nor. Sandishet, should actually enjoy. Samshritim, prolongation of material existence. Cha, and Atmanasam, forgetfulness of one's own constitutional position. Cha, as well as Tatra, in such a subject matter. Vidvan, one who is completely aware. Saha, such a person. Atmadrik, a self-realized soul. The translation of the verse by Srila Prabhupada. One who knows that material happiness, whether good or bad, in this life or in the next, on this planet or on the heavenly planets, is temporary and useless, and that an intelligent person should not try to enjoy or even think of such things, is the knower of the self. Such a self-realized person knows quite well that material happiness is the very cause of continued material existence and forgetfulness of one's own constitutional position. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The living entity is a spiritual soul, and the material body is his encagement. This is the beginning of spiritual understanding. Dehino smin yata dehe, komaran myovaram jara, tata dehantara prapti, diras tata samuyati. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body, from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. Bhagavad Gita 2:13. The real mission of human life is to get free from engagement in the material body. Therefore, Krishna descends to teach the conditioned soul about spiritual realization and how to become free from material bondage. Yada yadahi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. The words dharmasya glani mean pollution of one's existence. One existence is now polluted and it must be purified. Samsitim sudayet. The human life is meant for this purification, not for thinking of happiness in terms of the material body, which is the cause of material bondage. Therefore, in this verse, Maharaj Jayati advises that whatever material happiness we see and whatever is promised for enjoyment is all merely flickering and temporary. Sorry, this light is not very good, and I'm used to working under a very bright light, so when the Sanskrit comes and it's very small, it's a little hard. Anyway, I'll just leave it because I'll be struggling. Even if one is promoted to Brahmaloka, if one is not freed from material bondage, one must return to this planet Earth and continue in the miserable condition of material existence. Okay, one should always keep this understanding in mind so as not to be allured by any kind of sense enjoyment in this life or in the next. One who is fully aware of this truth is self-realized or atmadrik, but aside from him, everyone suffers in the cycle of birth and death, mritya, samsara, vartamani. This understanding is one of true intelligence, and anything contrary to this is but a cause of unhappiness. Krishna Bhakta, Nishkarma Atarena Sarata. Only a Krishna conscious person who knows the aim and object of life is peaceful. All others, whether karmis, gyanis, or yogis, are restless and cannot enjoy real peace. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Ramapada Swami Tinamine. Namom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Tinamine. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Navishesha Sunyavadi Paschacha Deshatarine. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Well, in beginning with the verse that's quoted by Srila Prabhupada from Bhagavad Gita 2:13, Dehinosmin yata dehe kovaram yovaram jara tata dehantara prapti dira tatra nasuyati muyati. So this verse is quoted by Srila Prabhupada as the defining verse for spiritual understanding. And it's a statement by Lord Krishna that allows for discernment to be made between the individual soul, which doesn't undergo any change, and the external manifestation of the soul, which is the body, and which is changing at every moment. So that change of body is seen as the soul manifesting either the body of a child or the body of a youth or even the body of an old person. And then this continues because there's transmigration into a new body. And that body may be either material once again or spiritual. This is a translation of that verse. As the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. So if this distinct mental separation is not made between the unchanging soul and the and the external encagement of the body, then the body, that external encagement, becomes the object for one's affection. And this is so because the it's related to the soul. And of course, the soul is very dear to one, to the self. And Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, when he's doing a commentary on this particular verse, he highlights that affection that comes from that external engagement for that external engagement of the soul. That in turn, what happens is that other things related to that body, because of that affection for the one body, then one also starts to have affection for those things related to that body, so meaning one's sons, one's daughters, one's brothers, one's family members. They also become objects of affection. You start with the one, and so it extends to anything connected to that particular body. And then by this relationship with the relatives, or the sons of relatives, even it can go to the next generation, they also become objects of affection. So the consequence of this is that due to the status that gets conferred upon all those individuals that are related to that affection one feels for one's own body, then naturally, when those particular bodies perish, there's definitely going to be an outward expression of grief, because wherever there's attachment and there's loss, then grief has to follow. So is interesting because there's a logic that's used by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur when he's explaining this statement of Lord Krishna that's, the fundamental basis for spiritual understanding. So he uses a logic that's going to help one to override this problem that results when one actually is not able to discern the difference between the soul and the body. And this is the logic of Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So, so in this body belonging to the jiva, that dehina, meaning the embodied, one attains stages such as boyhood. After boyhood is destroyed, one attains youth. When youth is destroyed, then one attains old age. So in the same manner, one attains another body. And here Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur introduces an interesting simile. In the same way that one doesn't lament for the destruction of the objects of affection in the form of one's boyhood or one's youth, so in the same way, one shouldn't actually be feeling some sort of distress when the body that's related to the soul, that means the, and in this particular verse there was the word tata, which is similarly, so Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is following the logic of Lord Krishna. He says one should also not lament for the destruction of the objects of affection, meaning all those around one. So it's very logical. But the only problem, of course, is that when there isn't this discernment between the soul and the engagement, there's always some sort of regret or grief or lamentation. And this does actually happen when youth is destroyed. So in the culture that we're residing in, it's very common for a great deal of distress to be present about the loss of youth. It's not treated lightly. And this is visible when youth is passed, and then all the incredible efforts that are put in to at least simulate the physical effects of youth. So some years ago, I was visiting some devotees, and the woman devotee of the house, because her husband's a doctor, was telling me that she was going through a whole course of particular injections that maintained and preserved youth. So I thought it was very interesting. It becomes so imbibed because one is existing in this culture that great effort is there to, take back or hold on to something of the youth that was there. So actually there is usually some distress about the loss of youth. It's not treated so lightly. So this problem of discernment between the soul and the body is not present in somebody who's referred to as a sober person. So it means somebody who's actually understood what is the purpose of having this human body or having this engagement around the soul, and that is actually to try and free oneself from the engagement. So if one's understood that, then, you know, there's a kind of, it's a sobering thought. It means one has to look beyond, you know, the youth elixirs or the, particular course of vitamins, plasma that's there to try and, work very hard on keeping the engagement very intact and presentable and, I guess, unwrinkled and very perky. So King Yayati, he gives a definition of one who's the knower of the self. And his definition of the knower of the self is somebody who's cognizant of the fact that the particular objects of affection related to the body and the enjoyment thereof is something to be given up when it's on a material level. So this is actually, you know, if one considers it, this is such an advanced idea. It's a very revolutionary idea, because the general understanding is that it's actually a healthy thing to have affection for all those that are related on a bodily level to one. So it's considered a very healthy thing to be very attached to one's family members generally. Of course, it doesn't happen so much, and probably that's why the emphasis on it being a healthy thing. It doesn't happen so easily in this society, actually. There isn't generally so much affection for one's family members because there's... on the material level, there's a lot of emphasis on the individual person extricating themselves from the family structure in order to carve their own path. So this actually means that there's often a state of conflict or strife in the regular family dynamic that exists in American culture. And so if we hear the definition of Maharaj Jayati, that somebody who's the knower of the self, meaning the has an understanding of the soul's existence in this external engagement, then it's actually, one needs to be cognizant that one has to actually give up these objects of affection related to the body or the enjoyment thereof. So this means that enjoyment may have been something that can even be very subtle, that enjoyment can be of things that one has heard even, or that, or things that one has seen. So it may not be actually a corporal object. And so this is continuation of this definition of Maharajayati, just being cognizant of this fact. This is the knower of the self, of needing to give up the objects of affection. It means that even things that one's heard or seen, that you know, the mind will grasp and hold on to and you know, examine, even on a very subtle level, one needs to actually be cognizant that one needs to move away from that. And in fact, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur speaks about that those same things that are held onto in the mind, one doesn't articulate it. Because the minute you actually articulate something, it actually becomes more tangible. So this is Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur. And earlier on, we'd heard about Prince Yadu, so Maharajayati's son, speaking of the necessity of enjoying material happiness. So here we have, you know, the other view being expressed. He was putting an emphasis on, no, it's actually necessary to have material happiness. So one may think, oh, well, this appears to be a slight discrepancy, but it's not, because one has to go through material enjoyment, especially during one's youthful years, because at that time the senses are extremely strong. So it means that, you know, desires are fueling those senses. And so since that's a reality, it is necessary to go through that material enjoyment. And this was Prince Yadu's point. It's actually necessary to go through it. And because then that brings one to that point of being able to be at peace with it. Oh, okay, I can push that aside. I've gone through it, and I know it's not actually that attractive as it appeared, but there is that necessity, because the senses are strong, to actually experience some of that material enjoyment. And he actually told his father, when he was requested to surrender his youth, and so this is now with understanding that the senses are very strong and are being fueled by all kinds of desires, he said, "I do not welcome your old age and invalidity, for unless one enjoys material happiness, he cannot attain renunciation. So it's necessary to run the course." Yeah, I was thinking about this a lot in relation to my own life, and I'm aware that, you know, over time through practicing Krishna consciousness and going through material enjoyment or what appeared to be necessary, just by the repetition, because everything's regulated by the repetition, one comes to a point of, oh, I'm doing that again and again and again. And then at some point it ceases to be so important. And mostly because of moving in the direction of greater attachment for Krishna. But it is necessary to go through it. And so, going back to this point of getting free from bodily engagement, usually it is necessary to give up that pursuit of material happiness. So there's the idea that one is holding, and that's the most powerful thing, that actually there's going to be happiness. So And that's the continued emphasis in these verses, that the happiness doesn't come from, you know, pursuing what the senses are pushing one towards. And this is Maharaj Yayati's particular understanding that he reached. He reached the understanding that this way of living, of pursuing happiness related to the body and its needs, is something that he went through. And we get a description, so I'm reading the description. Thereafter, King Yayati became the ruler of the entire world, consisting of seven islands, and ruled the citizens exactly like a father. Because he had taken the youth of his son, his senses were unimpaired, and he enjoyed as much material happiness as he desired. And continues, because he's going through the material happiness. So his bodily needs were related to the enjoyment of wealth, and also to sensual and bodily comforts, because we get a description, and I'm going to read the description that continues something of Maharaj Yayati going through this material enjoyment, and also the need of the senses to have the material enjoyment. So it continues, in secluded places, engaging her mind, body, and various paraphernalia, Devayani, the wife of Maharaj Yayati, always brought her husband the greatest possible transcendental bliss. So this is a description of King Yayati going through that material enjoyment. Now he's come to a point of being able to give up thinking of material enjoyment. So this is, you know, the idea part, which is the strongest part, because that's the part that fuels the desires and fuels the expression of giving space to the material senses. And he was able to give up this thinking of material enjoyment by contemplating the truth, because he had come to a point of maturity in his meditation on the Supreme Lord. So it says he'd performed sacrifices in which he'd offered abundant gifts to the Brahmanas, and to satisfy the Supreme Lord. So he's described as coming to be without material desires. So he was simultaneously, with giving space for the material senses, he was simultaneously performing sacrifice, because that was the also means of purifying those desires. And so he came to be without material desires, and he'd attained maturity in his meditation on Lord Narayan, that's described in this particular section. So by seeing the Lord in meditation, King Yayati understood the uselessness of happiness related to bodily and sensual comforts. So he no longer meditated on the objects of bodily comfort or sensual pleasure. So this is a very significant thing, because there's this verse that Srila Prabhupada quoted is so significant. Anyway, this anudayet, no longer thought of, it's in the verse here, he no longer thought of or identified with bodily comforts. This is Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He was no longer meditating on those sensual and bodily comforts. And this all came because he maintained that contact with the Lord through the performance of devotional service, his performing the various sacrifices for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord, while he's going through that expression of giving space to the material senses, you know, both the sensual and the bodily comfort, the wealth. So Srila Prabhupada says that actually, Lord Krishna, and this is in his purport, he comes to teach one this kind of purification of one's existence, meaning he brings the principles of religion. And anyway, when I was looking at this principle of religion, because here what's been dealt with is whole emphasis on the essential bodily comforts and the role that Devayani played in King Yayati's life, I came across this section of Kashyapa Muni, where he's actually following a particular principle that was in some sense highlighted by Prince Yadu, this being part of the four social orders of life. So one's actually practicing, one is engaged in spiritual practices within one of those four orders of life. And Kashyapa Muni, he's run into a situation where it's described that he actually also gave space to, sensual enjoyment, but he was engaged in austerity. So his wife had approached him, and she was in some sort of sensual frame of mind. And this is Kashyapa Muni, he actually praises her, which is very interesting. So it's a different angle. So this is what he says to his wife. As a fort commander very easily conquers plunderers by taking shelter of a wife, one can conquer the senses, which are unconquerable in the other social orders. So he actually praises his wife when she's in a sensual frame of mind. And of course, his praise extends through a long section of the Bhagavatam, and Srila Prabhupada does comment that there's a joking aspect to it too, but this is the beginning praise of his wife. So it means that also in going through this material enjoyment, when there's an attack on the body, so the engagement gets an attack, so to speak, by the senses, because they need that material enjoyment, then the wife is supposed to protect the body from getting smashed. This was Kashyapa Muni's praise of his wife. So she's actually a commander who's helping with the senses. So so in the same way that a man may be saved from the onslaught of enemies, so the wife was actually saving him from the onslaught of his senses. Now, in the other orders of society, Srila Prabhupada puts it, there has to be a systematic training. So, of course, of the brahmacharis, the vanaprastas too, and the sannyasis. So everybody has to go through some training. And this is because it's just natural that one's going to fall prey to the attack, particularly of wanting sensual enjoyment. So, and this is because one is bound to the body. There's no way of avoiding it. It's there. And so Srila Prabhupada puts it that a human being is meant to use one's life to address the discrepancies of something that's religious versus something that's irreligious. So that's actually what one is supposed to be doing, refining one's discernment continuously. You know, what's religious and what's irreligious. And he quoted this verse, yada yada hi dharmasya, and glani bhavati bharata abhyutam adharmasya tadatmanam srijami aham. So this is what that adharma is. Krishna's actually teaching that one needs to constantly be making this discernment. And this kind of correction of discrepancies, where one is actually thinking very carefully about where religion comes in and where irreligion comes in. So it's a very subtle thing, you know, what space one is giving for the senses and how one is actually managing that, the necessity for material enjoyment. So, so there has to be a kind of correction of discrepancies so that one's actually following religious principles. So one needs to shift one's meditation, and this is an understanding I got from this verse. One has to shift one's meditation of on material objects and in this verse this Tatra Vidvan, it's translated as one who's completely aware of such a subject matter. So that's what one wants to strive for, to increase one's awareness of the subtleties and the very fine distinctions one always has to make. Because this, if one's not in that kind of frame of mind, of trying to always correct discrepancies, then it produces samsara, meaning, you know, that continued engagement. And it actually also destroys spiritual consciousness. So it becomes essential to bear the principle in mind that this is actually what makes one, this Atmadrik, a self-realized soul. The fact that one's constantly discerning, making discernments, and this sets one aside from persons who don't have this kind of perception of being caught in the cycle of birth and death. And I turn to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So he gives a fantastic explanation of in terms of this kind of connection one can make with the Supreme Lord. So this is him talking. It is not possible for the mind of man to have the true conception of the actual nature of the unalloyed spiritual function. Such spiritual realization is possible only through the spiritual senses of the unconditioned soul. The functioning of the spiritual senses ensures the freedom of the soul from all unwholesomeness and limitations in a way that is exactly opposite of the activities of the present senses, which create and multiply the restrictions of this conditioned state. So it's a huge statement, but giving way to or taking the material senses and having material enjoyment, it creates unwholesomeness. That is Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's statement. And that is because there's one's at the mercy of the mind, and within the mind, there's always looking at things one way, looking at things another way, and then is it this way or is it that way? So there's something unhealthy about that. And if one is actually functioning with the connection with the Supreme Lord and the spiritual senses are functioning, so one's seen everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, the mind is peaceful, it's not operating, and there's a kind of sense of wholesomeness. One is functioning in a healthy way. So this particular statement came from a fantastic essay of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, where it's called The Erotic Principle and Unalloyed Devotion. The Erotic Principle, yeah. yeah. And going along with this, in Nectar of Devotion, there's a description of something of devotional principles, this connection with the Supreme Lord that allows for the operation of the spiritual senses. And probably of all those simple things that one does regularly in devotional life, the most significant one that confirms this process to oneself that one is the spirit soul is actually engaging in the process of deity worship. It actually makes alive the spiritual senses and brings about this confirmation that yes, indeed, I'm a spirit soul and this body is just an engagement. So these were some thoughts on this topic. I'm sorry if the class was a little dry today. It just came out that way. Some days it's more lively, but anyway, if there's any thought connected to this topic.
Hare Krishna. All right, Hare Krishna. Thank you for your class. I don't think any of your classes are dry. You do a lot of, I appreciate all your study. And if somebody thinks it's dry, if you use more words like erotic, then people might be more tense. But my question is related to your point and the point Prabhupada makes in a purport. You were mentioning, you said the purpose of human life is to become free from the engagement of the material body. So that reminds me of one of my favorite passages in the Bible, where in the book of John, where Jesus tells the Jews, he says, if you follow my teachings, then you will know the truth. Everyone knows this. And the truth will set you free. So then they said, we are Abraham's descendants. We're practically royalty. We have never been slaves of anyone. So how can you say that we should be set free? So Jesus says, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. And so he was saying, although you may be free on the outside, you're not free on the inside. Therefore, you're always disturbed. And Prabhupada actually mentions this in a verse. He quotes a verse that Chaitanya spoke to Rupa Goswami. Krishna bhata nishkama ata eva shant, bhuti muti siddhi kami sakali ashant. That we're always ashant, disturbed, because we're slaves of our senses. Slaves of lust, slaves of anger, envy, etc. So my question is that one point I was making to Subal the other day is that when they brought the slaves, or any slaves, but I'm particularly talking about the Africans, when they brought the Africans over to America, the slaves outnumbered the masters, but they were able to subjugate them because they had weapons and stuff. But within our body, there's only one slave, the soul, and there's many masters. Our lust, our anger, our greed, our envies, you could count them. So it seems like there's no escape. Some slaves. So my question is essentially is that when lust, when we feel like we're free from lust, then pride takes a shift. It has a 12-hour shift. Then then when we're free from pride, we feel like it. Then we then embarrassment. So many things take shifts. They take shifts. So there's no question of getting out. So my question is that a lot of times it's a point of emphasis. A lot of devotees, we hear in the scriptures that it is possible to control the senses. But at the same time, we also hear Arjuna said that it's impossible to control the senses. It is easier to control the wind than the mind. So I feel like people, one point I like to emphasize, and maybe you could expand on it, that one thing to keep myself enthusiastic that I try to keep in mind that it's not possible to control the mind. It's not possible to control the senses. And so so Krishna's Ishwara Paramah, he's the supreme controller. So how much emphasis should the people give on controlling the senses? Because it really isn't. That's Krishna's mercy. There's so many verses we could discuss, on and on about different points. But my understanding that it's not possible to control the senses, but we're just trying to evoke that mercy so we could be free from the senses. So it's kind of point of emphasis. Maybe you could describe, is it possible or is it possible? My understanding that it's not possible. But also, okay. Hare Krishna.
So Jai Baladev, he drew attention to something biblical that Christ was also giving the teaching that persons needed to become free by following his teachings, and that there wasn't an understanding of that because the persons took it in the literal sense that actually they weren't slaves, so why did they have to be become free? And he went on from there to look at this problem that actually there are many masters that are internally operating, and those masters may be in the form of lust or anger or greed. And so he was of the thought that actually it's extremely difficult to control the senses, that really actually one is just looking to invoke the mercy of Krishna. So his question is, is it actually possible to control the senses, or is it that indeed one is kind of helpless and just looking to the mercy of Krishna for bringing the senses under control? So it's an interesting question. I found when you brought up the initial understanding that was expressed from the biblical quotation that's or from the Bible that you were bringing up, there's degrees of subtlety of understanding. So persons, generally the Bible goes along or is geared towards teaching persons who are consuming flesh. So where there's flesh consumption, there's because it's a sinful activity performed, it inhibits proper understanding. So the understanding of freedom being internal freedom versus just a subjugation, a freedom from subjugation, it's seems like a very what would be the word, very external kind of understanding. So I'm just relating it to the consumption of flesh, that, you know, the subtlety of the understanding wasn't there. So going on from that, you moved to the existence of a very subtle, I guess, we called it masters, in the form of anger or lust or greed. And those are all related to desires for enjoyment of some kind. I mean, there's lust because there's a desire to enjoy more. There's greed because there's a desire to enjoy more. There's anger because the desire to enjoy wasn't satisfied. So they aren't masters as such. They're merely expressions of the desire that is there, and the desire for some external tangible enjoyment comes from a concept one is holding. So if the concept is that my senses need to find satiation in something external, then that's what has the side effect of the engulfment of one's intelligence by this voracious appetite, or the engulfment of one's intelligence and mind by this greed to have particular kinds and more of a particular kind of enjoyment. And then, of course, the part of the distress or the even anger, if that isn't fulfilled. So they aren't masters, rather they rest, everything comes from the concept one is holding. So it's a belief system. If one holds a certain belief, then all one's actions follow that belief. So if the belief is that one of needing satiation for one's material senses, that that's how one's going to achieve happiness and satisfaction, then everything follows. So they're not masters. They're just byproducts of a belief system. So this is the beauty of Krishna consciousness, the presentation of an alternative belief system. So the belief that the senses one wants to satisfy are the spiritual senses of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is such a radical concept, because it shifts one's whole attention. The external now is, well, for us, there's always the form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the deity form. So one's shifting the belief system to one of finding one's own satisfaction and happiness in giving satisfaction and happiness to the deity form of the Lord. So that kind of shift is completely pushing aside the other belief system. So then one operates in a different way. One follows the new belief system. So one's activities then and one's thought process and one's behavior changes completely. Then even when something's on a subtle plane, which I think I was sort of bringing up, because, you know, of course there's always gross behavior, which one can easily witness, you know, if one's holding a different belief system. But on a very subtle level, because the belief system's been there a very long time, I mean, supposed to have been many lifetimes, then on a subtle level, one may still be having so many images, so many sounds, so many memories. And of course, the intelligence can also fill in imaginatively. And, you know, like in comic books, all the individuals have a little balloon above, which shows, you know, whatever the fantasy is. So one also creates those through the imagination. So it's already existing on a subtle level. So one's now shifted one's belief system to looking for happiness in the satisfying the senses of Lord Krishna, but there's still this whole subtle package that one has. So then the work is more subtle, because then one has to actually monitor. So the monitoring takes the form of connecting anything that comes with Krishna. So, you know, whether it's, you know, the balloon that comes, you know, one connects it with Krishna, whatever the imagination is filled in. Or if it's something old, then one looks at it and asks oneself, is one actually really going to act on that? You know, so there has to be that examination. One can't passively ride along and let, you know, give way to that old belief system. And there's no necessity to, because you now are at the lotus feet of the master of the senses. So you're quite correct. There's the kindness of Krishna that he actually protects one, that just by one making the effort to monitor, he's present, and one has the strength to not go with the old belief system and the old package of both gross and subtle behavior. So that's a thought to share, at least, you know, what I guess I've tried to communicate in thinking on this topic. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, thank you, Masterji. I had two questions. One, in the section where you're describing Devayani's role in the enjoyment of King Yayati, you mentioned that by giving so many things and acting in this way, she increased his transcendental bliss. So I remember looking at that and I was confused because that seems more like material happiness, but the word it says is transcendental bliss. So how he was getting transcendental bliss from material things?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The question of Devayani having actually used what's described as her body, her mind, her words to actually give transcendental bliss. So the question is, how is it that, you know, satisfying something material, meaning the sensual needs or the bodily needs of King Yayati, can be called transcendental? And how can it be producing transcendental bliss, means their spiritual emotion? So the, I mean, how one would understand it is that, and I think Naveen Krishna Prabhu yesterday made one of the comments in his class was that King Yayati was functioning on a religious plane. So he wasn't on an irreligious plane. So although he had, you know, very perfect senses that he'd acquired from his son because he wanted to enjoy to the maximum, and that was his intention, and he had the that voracious appetite as well to enjoy something material, meaning the sensual pleasure connected to Devayani or contact with Devayani. At the same time, he was performing his religious duty. So it's said that he was ruling the citizens like a father. So it means, you know, very loving, careful, thoughtful, concerned for their welfare. So he's fulfilling his religious duty as a king. And then on the home front, he was also fulfilling his religious duty because he was performing sacrifices. So simultaneous with his, you know, again, what's there on the subtle plane manifesting itself through his needing those bodily comforts, those sensual enjoyments. Simultaneous with that, by performing his religious duties, there's the connection with the Supreme Lord. So he's actually cultivating attachment to the Supreme Lord, and his spiritual senses are also coming alive, because when you connect with the Supreme Lord, you spiritual senses are operating. So in that particular situation, you're then looking at an individual that's functioning, his spiritual senses are operating as well as his material senses. And it would appear that in his case, he seemed to go more in the direction of material senses. And your question was, how was it that he was also experiencing transcendental bliss through his wife cooperating with fulfillment of his sensual, physical, bodily needs? Well, his spiritual senses were also operating. So he's functioning as a devotee. So it's not exclusively as a materialist who's viewing everything on a gross level. So, and his wife is, you know, on the same path as he is. So she's also getting the benefit of those sacrifices that are being performed. So yeah, the understanding would be that we're looking at an individual that's not a gross materialist. He's actually connected with the Supreme Lord, and over those 1,000 years through that connection with the Supreme Lord, and he came to a point of understanding, I now desire to serve the Supreme Lord exclusively. And this particular verse is, he's actually turned his attention away from wanting to find some sort of happiness in having his material senses attended to. So that is how I understood it. We're looking at an individual who's progressing on the spiritual path. So his spiritual senses are operating. Yeah, so that was the thought.
And was this translation, it mentions that material happiness is the root cause of material existence and forgetting one's constitutional position, right? So conversely, that would mean that material suffering is the cause of awakening one's spiritual identity and realizing transcendental knowledge. But we see that just the presence of suffering in the world doesn't actually awaken one to transcendental knowledge. There's another component. I was wondering if you wanted to comment.
That's a nice observation being made that, you know, one observes. So if one says that, you know, there's the, that suffering as a converse to, you know, allowing for, well, if a satiation of material happiness allows for some sort of awakening of the soul, then would it not also be that suffering could do the same thing? But, you know, the observation is if one looks around, that's not necessarily the case. So the question being asked is, I guess, how is it that suffering isn't bringing about this awakening of the soul? Yeah, it's an interesting question. Well, the happiness that's coming from finding the expression in some sort of material area of gratifying the senses is short-lived, and there's concomitant suffering that comes even from that immediately after that experience, that short-lived experience of happiness, like immediately after, because in this world, you can't separate out the happiness and the distress. They go together. So it's like the same package. It's not that there's one separate package of happiness and one separate package of distress. Within the happiness, material happiness, there's distress. They go together. So it's intertwined. So, which actually is very interesting, because then surely in the mind, it would become apparent, it would be a learned thing that with this way of getting happiness, I'm also going to get distress, because you can't separate it out. They do go together. So that, in terms of your observation, it would mean that constantly persons should be having that learning that, oh, the happiness comes with distress. But yet somehow there's only the seeing of the happiness. Even though the distress is definitely there, there's no way of separating it out. like there was one time when I had to go and see a chiropractor because I'd very enthusiastically tried to make a hole in the ground to plant a bush, and I'd done many repetitive motions with my hand to dig a hole. So then this chiropractor was telling me that she had just been on vacation, and she had been water skiing, or, you know, those where you attach yourself on skis to a boat. She'd been on one of those, and somehow or other she'd fallen and she damaged the very limb of her body that does the most work, you know, the arm and the hand. And yeah, so, you know, the happiness and the distress, you can't separate them out. So that was a very graphic example. So why then does a person not learn that, you know, if you are in a very greedy way looking for your own happiness, that you're also going to experience distress? It's odd. It's very odd. But looking at the question of why does the soul not come alive? Why does that looking for an existential reality separate from that very corporal reality that one's inhabiting? Why is it not sparked by this new understanding? It's a very interesting question. And I think if one connects it to King Yayati, there has to have been some unknown transcendental piety that allows for the soul to awaken. So there was some transcendental piety that allowed King Yayati to awaken. So the same thing, somebody may be not even getting that learning of happiness and distress going together, but the person who does is the person who somehow unknowingly has performed some act that was a transcendentally pious act in some way. And or maybe there's some little question that arises in the mind, is this all there is? Just that little question may then bring the person the good fortune of a person carrying transcendental knowledge crossing their path. Well, I'll tell you a personal example. I think I was going through a period of some suffering when I finished university, because I was actually questioning things. And I was visiting a friend in a different city, and she just told me, she made one comment about Lord Krishna. And the minute I heard Lord Krishna, a whole image came into my mind, and you know, I actually was seeing the form of Lord Krishna, and where that came from, I do not know. So I'm relaying that personal example. One doesn't know what is there from a past life or past something. So that person who gets that, makes that connection between happiness and distress going together, and actually looks to a further existential reality, is the person who somehow unknowingly has had some transcendental piety.
Yeah, I just had a thought also that the suffering, it allows receptivity to the message of the sadhus or the devotees, or that transcendental. That message may be given in two circumstances, one in ample material happiness and one in ample material distress. Generally, unless one gets that material kick, that message, it doesn't really enter the heart so much. There's not that need for an transcendental alternative. So I'm just sharing also in that sense. Thank you for your...
Thank you very much. They're connecting it to need, yeah. Jitendra Prabhu has.
Prabhupada says that people are blind to self-realization, and the leaders want to keep them blind so they can consume them with, you know, all kinds of a network of sense gratification. Mm-hmm. I remember somebody giving a class saying that in Beverly Hills, California, they don't allow any funeral homes, but they allow beauty parlors and all this stuff, because they don't want people to think about death. Hmm. So they can control them by, you know. And then it says that the conditioned soul never tires of the three modes of material nature. He just goes from one to the other, trying to enjoy here and there, like a buffet of food. You know, oh, let me try this, oh, let me try that. So he never tires of the modes of nature. And then they asked Prabhupada, what is the Western world good for? And Prabhupada said, the Western world is good for preaching and sense gratification. And it says the conditioned soul hates transcendence because he's so absorbed in his, you know, his network of illusions. There's a phrase that's also used that says he's madly engaged in chewing the chewed. And let's see. Oh, you can find out where a person's at by asking him what is his sense of happiness. Srila Prabhupada liked the hippies in a sense. He said because they were renounced, but he said they couldn't give up sex life. So that was their stumbling block. When one has a higher taste, he can give up the lower taste. But and then from pride comes cruelty. From pride comes cruelty. So we see a lot of people that the more wealth they have, the more they try to dominate other people, and you know, brings out cruelty. I think that was Chanaka Pandit said that. Hare
Krishna. Thank you very much, Atendra Prabhu, for sharing those statements. I guess, yeah. Oh, we've gone way over time, and I'm usually so good at like being right on the dot. This is the first time I've ever gone over. So sorry, but thank you very much for your kind contributions. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Thank you.